Welcome to the Doctor's Life Podcast with Diane Ansari Wynn, MD. Dr. Diane is a stress and burnout coach for doctors. With her 15 years of experience as an anesthesiologist and certification as a physician development coach, Dr. Diane coaches doctors on how to live a rich life of purpose, fulfillment, freedom, and happiness both at work and at home. In this podcast, Dr. Diane brings together doctors and researchers that are experts in health, wellness, stress, and burnout, as well as doctors that have been successful in clinical practice, academics, non-clinical careers, and business to share their expertise and life experience so that you can live your own life purpose, fulfillment, freedom, and happiness. To get free access to a PDF and video of easy and proven strategies that melt stress away and keep it away, simply register at www.dianeansari-win.com. That's www.dianeansari-win.com. Now here is your host, Dr. Diane Ansari Wynn.
Hi, it's Dr. Diane here, and I have a quick request before we jump into the show. If you like this podcast, it would mean so much if you took just a moment to hop over to iTunes, write a review, and rate the show. That is how other people will find the show and get the same great value from it that I hope that you're getting. It just takes a few moments to click a star rating and write a quick note. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the Doctor's Life podcast today. Today, we have an amazing interview. We're going to be discussing implicit bias with Dr. Brenda J. Allen. She's a PhD from Howard University, and she's the Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion and a Professor of Communication at the University of Colorado, Denver and the Anschutz Medical Campus. Dr. Allen's scholarship and teaching focus on organizational communication and social identity, such as gender, race, sexuality, age, ability, nationality, and social class. She has an emphasis on diversity in higher education. Among her many publications is a groundbreaking book, Difference Matters, Communicating Social Identity. And Dr. Allen presents keynote speeches, conducts workshops, and provides consultation on topics such as implicit bias, which we're going to discuss today, as well as inclusion in the workplace, strategic planning, culturally responsive teaching, mentoring, and diversity hiring practices. Welcome, welcome, Dr. Allen. It's a thrill.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to join you today.
It's quite an honor. So glad to have you today. Well, Dr. Allen, we usually start off the podcast. Those of you who have been listening know this already. But the people that I interview, I feel, are so inspirational. And everybody has their CV and their bio and, you know, more of their formal titles. But I like to have all the guests share how they got to where they are now and how they got to be doing the work that they're so passionate about. Mm-hmm. So before we get into talking about implicit bias, let's hear some more about you.
Thank you. I have to think a bit in terms of the long career path that I've had, which has also been quite productive. And I think the best place to begin would be when I was working at Howard University as a lecturer, and at the same time I was earning my PhD, because as an employee, one could take courses as part of employee benefits. So I was working on my PhD at the time to complete it when I got a phone call from someone at the University of Colorado Boulder, basically a recruitment call to encourage me to apply for a position there. Even though I wasn't actively seeking, I thought I'd take a chance and actually was hired in the Department of Communication at the University of Colorado Boulder in 1989. And I think it's better even to say I was recruited as a black woman to that campus.
Right.
From there, I was focusing on looking at computer-mediated communication. As you noted earlier, my broad area of study is organizational communication. And at the beginning of my career, I was looking at how people use computer-mediated devices within organizational systems to share meaning with one another, and really was planning to make a career of that. Mm-hmm. However, when I got to CU Boulder, I was fascinated by what I later learned to call identity politics, of looking at how one's identity matters in most settings, but especially in higher education. For example, assumptions people made about me as a Black woman in communication, that I probably studied intercultural communication or gender in communication. That's just one example. Mm-hmm. So I was so intrigued by that that I actually changed my area of scholarship, research, and teaching to focus on social identities, beginning with race and gender, but then expanding far beyond that to the categories you mentioned and others, and also ways that they intersect. I also became very intrigued by how power operates as we look at those identity dynamics. So that's it, kind of in a nutshell. How I came to look at implicit bias is connected directly to looking at power and identity. How I came to be a chief diversity officer, a vice chancellor, is connected to my actual career path from assistant professor to tenured associate professor to full professor to department chair to associate dean, and now in my role as vice chancellor. And in between becoming an associate professor with tenure, I moved to the downtown Denver campus, to the department there, and that's where I became a department chair and had the other leadership roles. About 5 years or so ago, I was invited to assume the role of vice chancellor, which then gave me oversight of both the downtown Denver campus and the Anschutz Medical Camp.
Mm-hmm. So people that don't quite understand maybe what it means to be the vice chancellor for diversity and inclusion, or the chief diversity officer. Can you explain to us what that involves?
Yes, thank you. That is an important question. And that role of chief diversity officer itself varies across institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's really important in this case and actually influenced my decision to accept the offer is that I'm a member of the upper level leadership. So I'm a member of the chancellor's cabinet. And this is crucial in terms of having a long and lasting impact. So that's one important point. The other point is that as having oversight of two campuses, that encompasses 13 schools and colleges, each of which all of us know in higher education can have its own culture, its own concerns, its own opportunities in terms of achieving the overarching educational mission. So that becomes an important element of how I enact my role as chief diversity officer. The primary goal, purpose of my role is to be the champion to achieve our university's diversity strategic priority. So this is actually within our strategic plan for the two campuses, and it states that we strive to enhance diversity university-wide and to foster a culture of inclusion.
What does diversity and inclusion mm-hmm. mean these days?
Mm-hmm.
I hear it mentioned a lot. Diversity and Inclusion Month, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, okay,
yeah.
What does that mean, you know, when you granulate it a little bit more?
That's another really important question, and it's something that anyone who is engaging in diversity and inclusion work should clarify at the outset. For example, one thing I've found, and it's a reason why I do exactly this, is in higher education, people tend to conflate diversity with race. And they don't seem to also consider other aspects of diversity. Our framework for diversity recognizes historically underrepresented groups of persons in the areas of race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, veteran status, and ability status, and it couples it with other dimensions such as nationality, religion, socioeconomic status, and ways that they intersect with one another. So I appreciate that the diversity strategic priority, which I inherited, I didn't help with developing it, but mm-hmm. I appreciate that the persons who wrote it were very thoughtful about saying, well, what do we really mean?
Just to delve into that just a little bit deeper.
Okay.
Does that mean then, is that kind of like a quota thing or percentages? There's been some controversy about that over the years.
In the case of our campuses and specifically the way that I'm engaging this role, really not focusing on anything like quotas or affirmative action. Rather, we're really concentrating on providing access to groups who traditionally and currently have not had the access. And doing that because we view it as not only a moral, ethical imperative, but frankly, more and more, an economic imperative as well as an economic asset, recognizing that diversity is a means by which, one, we can respond to the changing demographics in our world and in our society based on some of the categories I mentioned. And most people, of course, hone in on the demographics around race and ethnicity. But there are also mm-hmm. those regarding gender, regarding religion, regarding sexual orientation and so forth. And so from a very basic bottom line approach, we need to be concerned about being institutions that are accessible and will help everybody to succeed. And that also leads to something I should also clarify before I say a bit more in terms of your current question, is mm-hmm. what we mean by inclusion. Inclusion refers to the very basic definition of inclusion, which is a sense that no matter who you are, you feel welcomed, invited, and respected. And so that means everybody. And then inclusion also means that we are thoughtful to include those who have been traditionally excluded. So that's, again, that's an important perspective because it emphasizes that when we talk about diversity and inclusion, we're talking about everyone regardless of their particular identity composition. So the idea that you just mentioned of a white male, that white males should feel as valued, should feel they have the same kind of access, while at the same time, we're careful that we're not reproducing the kinds of isms that have left some people behind.
Right. Thank you for explaining that. I have a much clearer understanding of that now, and I hope our audience does too. And it actually ties us more specifically to the topic that we've mentioned a couple of times that we're going to discuss in mm-hmm. for the rest of the podcast today, which is implicit bias. Since part of your work, I would say that the beginning of any type of diversity and inclusion work is being more thoughtful of mm-hmm. others in general.
Mm-hmm.
Implicit bias is so important because it actually we're looking at how can we be fair with everyone.
Right.
What is implicit bias from, because I want to ask the expert. I have my own idea of what it means, but I want to ask
yeah.
the expert.
Okay.
What is implicit bias and how can we recognize it?
Implicit bias refers to ways that we as human beings unknowingly draw upon assumptions, stereotypes, about individuals and groups based only on their identity in a group, their membership in a group, to make decisions about them. And it's a type of cognition that occurs involuntarily, automatically, and beyond one's own awareness. The way that these biases occur is that they tend to be triggered in contexts where we're quickly judging or doing something that is, as I said earlier, automatic, and it has to do with people in different situations. And it's important to note that these processes are natural, and they can be valuable because they can help us to be more efficient. But on the other hand, they can have really harmful consequences because we then may make connections between people and either negative or positive attributes and end up choosing to, for example, hire someone versus not hiring another person simply on a cue of the person's name sounds white or sounds black. And this is the kind of research that's been done in this area.
Implicit bias has some positive aspects and has some negative impact. Would you give a couple of examples of maybe where it is positive and where not so positive?
Certainly. The ways that implicit bias can be positive refer more to decisions that aren't focused on human beings or individuals. So zooming out from the focus as we have in doing implicit bias professional development on thinking about how to be more equitable in different contexts is that thinking about, for example, the kinds of ways that we have preferences or predispositions about anything. So, for instance, of making a decision of which restaurant to go to for dinner, maybe not even thinking it through, but just sort of as an automatic, it's a predisposition. So when I talk about it being potentially negative or positive, I'm really focusing more on the kind of everyday ways that we are biased, and we can be biased either in explicit or implicit ways. We can be conscious of our predispositions and preferences, or we can have them and act upon them without even being aware of it.
When you are giving a workshop at the medical campus, what is it that you're sharing with the healthcare professionals there? Mm-hmm. And what is their response then?
Regardless of the audience, I start with talking about implicit bias being natural, and it's something that is hard, that we tend to do as human beings, period. I also talk about the neuroscience work that looks at how our brains work. And I refer explicitly to work by economist Daniel Kahneman. Are you familiar with it, The Thinking Fast and Slow?
No, actually, that would probably be helpful for all of us to learn.
Yes. Really, really powerful work, because it talks about how in various situations we as human beings will either think very quickly and make decisions based on thinking and based on how we have been socialized and oriented, or we'll slow down and think it through and be much more likely to make better informed decisions. So I start with that. And I start with that because it's a way of saying, look, folks, we all are likely to do it because it's how our brains work. And it's how implicit bias works, is because we have all been wired, if you will, or we've been exposed to issues that are wiring us, that are giving us schemas when it comes to other human beings. And with that, then, we all have been exposed to negative beliefs about different categories in our society. And that's compounded in healthcare systems, because in healthcare education, as it tends to focus on health disparities and challenges with particular groups, it necessarily highlights negative aspects. But the problem is then that those in the healthcare professions may be even more likely than the rest of us to come into those settings having been socialized to view, to think about different populations based on ways that they have been exposed. And this is the other challenge, in addition to that challenge as potentially influencing their interactions, is it's also a challenge when people who in their heart of hearts don't have any prejudice, who know themselves to care about all people, to not be racist, sexist, and so forth. So there's this contradiction that I try to get in front of by talking about our brains work in this way. Mm-hmm. So that's a start to the process for these workshops and discussions. And I make them very interactive and invite people to kind of reflect on how this may be operating in their lives. Mm-hmm. So then, from the broad overview of what is implicit bias, how does it tend to work, it's about our brains, and it's about how we make assumptions that tend to arise because of how we've been taught. For example, one research project showed that medical students have this assumption, this particular research project, mm-hmm. a high percentage of those subjects really thought that African Americans have a higher threshold for pain than white. And if you try to track, where in the world did they get that from?
Yeah, I'm like, really?
Right?
Yes. My first thought is, really?
Yes. Yes. And by the way, as we talk about ways that people are predisposed to implicit bias, and therefore having thoughts, unless we try to get in touch with those thoughts that could influence their behaviors, please know that this is everybody. So when we talk, for instance, about implicit bias related to gender and therefore the likelihood of treating women and men, if we use a traditional gender binary, although now we also need to think across the gender spectrum, so mm-hmm. ways people may treat engage with persons who are transgender, as another example, is recognize that it's regardless of the person's own category under that particular social identity. So I usually also am ready to talk about the most recent example from my own life of how I have probably revealed my own implicit bias about a particular group. So this is an equal opportunity kind of way of thinking. It's what I call TUI, thinking under the influence of dominant belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
So I move from that broad overview of what is it, and I talk about a little bit about the implications of making those associations between people and groups and ways that you make decisions, to then talking a little bit about broad-based research. So research on that's looked at anything from in the professions of law and social justice, of looking at education, looking at just employment practices in general, which shows time and time and time again that people are making decisions based on their implicit biases for or against a particular group. And these research projects include ones that I alluded to earlier, for example, of sending out thousands of resumes that are exactly the same. The only thing different on the resumes would be the name. And researchers began doing this by looking at, as I mentioned earlier, black-sounding names and white-sounding names. For instance, Lakeisha or Emily. And that would be the only difference on the resumes. And the persons who would reach out to Lakeisha or Emily, they, to a statistically significantly higher degree, would do a callback or indicate an interest in interviewing Emily than Lakeisha. So those kinds of projects, there's also been projects that looked at Arab Muslim-sounding names and non-Arab Muslim-sounding names, male names and female names. So that's one area of research, hiring, evaluation, ways that there's one recently that looked at educators, and they actually asked, I think it may have been K-12 educators, to view a video of four little children engaging with one another in a classroom. And they asked them to kind of get a sense of how the children were behaving. And what they did not know is that they were tracking their eye movement. And they found that the teachers, again, regardless of their race, tended to focus much more on the little black boy than the other kids in the classroom. And this is, just to give you a little sample of the exciting kinds of research that's been done and mm-hmm. the disturbing results that show we've just all been socialized in ways that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I move from that as I talk with healthcare audiences, and I'm very pleased that I've done this kind of work to a variety of audiences, not only on my campuses, but, for example, I just came back from Tucson, where I worked with their healthcare center doing some work, and was very gratified by their responses as I talk with them about why this matters so much in healthcare. Why it's important to, for instance, understand that the implicit bias influences across the spectrum of healthcare. It starts even with whether or not someone aspires to be a healthcare provider, a member of the healthcare profession. So that, and then it goes from there all the way across to who enters the healthcare professions, which ones they choose to go into. I've done some work recently with the area of radiology and have found some striking, startling data which show women and underrepresented racial ethnic minorities, just a strong paucity of them, and then can trace that to a variety of variables, many of which the evidence indicates implicit bias has been operating. So anyway, I talk with them about why we need to look at implicit bias in healthcare. It's not just the kind of obvious what happens with interactions between providers and patients. Mm-hmm. It also affects education dynamics, how people are socialized, as I said, regarding the professions. It influences admissions processes. So back to the looking at what kinds of cues people unconsciously rely on to make decisions, those same kinds of things like sounding names or where you went to school or et cetera can matter in terms of who gets admitted, looking at the curriculum, what kinds of things are you covering. A group of students of color from one school that I work with actually came to me to express their concern that their curriculum focused only on negative aspects of race. And they were concerned about what that meant, not only for how their peers were looking at them as prospective providers, but mm-hmm. also what that might mean for as everyone then leaves their education and goes out into their various fields. It influences evaluation across all of the aspects of from education to clinical practice to doing research. It can influence research practices, research design. In radiology, of looking at patterns of who goes into even which type of radiology. So women are more likely to be in areas of radiology that have to do with women's health care. And by the way, this is where this also comes circling back to impact on health disparities and health equity. Currently, the persons who tend to aspire to work on health disparities, who care about underrepresented communities, are persons who are members of those communities. So if we're not striving to improve access for them into the professions, then that has the additional potential challenge of us not being able to address those effectively.
This can be a highly charged subject.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
And I love how you brought out that it's not about placing fault or blame or wrong. As Dr. Allen's talking, just like take this on with an open mind.
Yeah,
and just something that in order for us healthcare professionals to become great at our jobs and what we do and help be a force for good in the world, like I assume everybody we all want to do, it's just important to look at it, and that's why Dr. Allen is here.
Yes, so you really have captured the approach that I take not only to the professional development and training and writing that I'm doing on this topic, but also to how I'm living it, and that I am open to finding, and I, interestingly enough, I actually am finding ways that probably I'm demonstrating implicit bias. So mm-hmm. the question people have, well, if it's implicit or unconscious, how do I even know that I'm doing it? So we have to start there. And the place to begin is to make a commitment that you are going to do better when it comes to implicit bias. And that's where I hope that I have succeeded with the persons with whom I'm working to help them know how urgent and important it is, and that they can make a difference, and that it's not about whether they are themselves prejudiced against certain groups. And that's the thing, is you've got to really become committed to this because you see why and how it matters. And I give recommendations for individuals and the institution, and it's got to start with us as individuals, mm-hmm. understanding that these biases can contradict our values, and that's all the more reason to become committed to managing them. I think that what's also helpful is reviewing research about implicit bias that's particular to your area, because that then can be a cue for getting in front of how you might be engaging in implicit bias as an individual. I think it's also important, one means by which you can assess your own propensity for bias is the implicit association test. That's out of Harvard University, and it's existed for quite a while now. anybody can readily find it if they just Google implicit association test or even just IAT. And it takes you through a series of very quick flashing pictures or words at you, and you have to readily respond, which captures that idea of implicit biases about rapid cognition.
Right.
It measures how you associate an identity group, for example, women or persons who are LGBTQ, with evaluations or stereotypes such as good or bad, nurturing or dominating. And that test then measures how quickly you're making those associations, and at the end of it, it tells you whether you have something like a moderate, mild, no, or extreme association with negative in a group or positive in a group. Those tests indicate that we lean toward the stereotypes. So taking those tests is something that I find can be helpful, although people resist them and they want to say, well, they want to just contest the validity of the test. And I go back to something you just shared, which is just be open-minded. This is not about you being a bad person. This is about you being a product of your environment. Mm-hmm. I also think that individuals should deepen their commitment to getting the skills that can help them to manage bias. So, again, the work I've been doing recently is looking at radiology, and one project on radiologic technologists showed just trying to take the perspective of others, of patients, and trying to imagine the challenges they face and so forth. Some research has shown that that can help mitigate unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. Also, it's important to get evidence-based knowledge about groups and thinking about groups as being much more complex than sometimes we give them credit for. So you may, for instance, think about the combination of young black male in a particular way. And even if you're honest with yourself, when someone says a particular, or you think about a particular category, is just try to get in touch with, well, what are stereotypes about them, mm-hmm. even when you don't have them? And then to tell yourself that, my gosh, there's so much more to persons than I know. A way that I appeal to people in that regard is I ask them to think about, for instance, if I ask you, could you name 25 different identity categories that matter to you, for who you are. So you mentioned earlier coach. You talked about family. So you're a mother. You're a physician yourself, et cetera. And how do you identify in terms of gender and race? Those matter, but you're much more complex. So that's another important point. Looking for counter stereotypes really makes a big difference. And also, very simply, slow down when you're making decisions. Remember,
yeah.
This all comes back to rapid cognition.
Right.
So you're
right.
Doing something, and certainly the other piece of this is recognizing places where implicit bias is likely to occur would be when you're making quick decisions, when you don't have enough information, when you're operating on kind of automatic pilot, when you are distracted, when you're under stress. And I worked recently with police officers, and also as I think about certain kinds of aspects of the medical profession, I say, so that's probably every day for you, right? That these are the conditions under which you're working.
Right.
So those are a few things at the individual level that you can do.
Dr. Allen, you were describing that what we can do on the individual level, and does implicit bias show up on the institutional level as well?
Oh, most definitely. In fact, that's crucial to understand and to address. So starting with the individual is key to looking at anything we as individuals are doing within our various institutions. We also have to have a sense of how even our behaviors and attitudes ultimately not only influence things at the institutional level, but vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So there's implicit bias built into policies and procedures, into ways that we hire, recruit, et cetera, looking at our criteria, looking at how we are even promoting who we are, so looking at promotional materials, marketing materials, looking at the kinds of hoops one has to jump through for any aspect of both the educational and practice and clinical elements of our institutions. So there are things that one can do similar to the individual level at the institutional level. So looking at data matters. So mm-hmm. people can begin to look at patterns in things such as recruitment, retention, mentoring programs, research opportunities, appraisal processes that might be affected by implicit biases. And mm-hmm. in looking at those data, look to see what kinds of differences might be occurring. In particular, looking at the places where we gather data like gender and race, and even looking at that, being sure that we disaggregate those data. So we're not just looking at women and men, we're also looking further at the racial, you know, the crosstabs of race and gender. And sometimes that can be very telling. I worked with a group recently where the head of that group went back to his organization and looked at the data and called me because he was appalled that he wasn't even tracking the low, low, low percentage of persons from diverse backgrounds. Now, this circles back to your earlier question about affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
And the point here is not at all to say then you need to increase those numbers and so forth, but rather it's to look at your processes and procedures to see and to recognize if you really are committed to diversity, what can you do better so that you are, you're not doing anything unintentionally that leads to the data that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other, of course, the important part is to provide professional development, such as the kind of workshop and training that I've been talking about, to look for through all your employment processes, how you screen resumes or applications, how you conduct interviews, how do you onboard new persons, assign mentors, evaluate performance, who gets promoted or terminated. Are you doing exit interviews to have a sense of what are people's experiences? Looking at patients and clients and trying to get a sense of what's so for them. And there are many promising practices like holistic reviews, looking at rubrics for making decisions. One thing that's especially exciting for me is research has shown that if groups are getting ready to make a decision, if you just implore them to be fair, if you ask them to focus on equity, that makes a much better difference than if you say, don't be racist, right? If you're not,
right.
you're coming at it about be compliant no matter what.
Right,
but
right.
If you say, let's really be thoughtful about what we're doing because we do indeed value diversity, that makes a difference. It's also important to rely both on the individual level and the institutional level is to have the kind of open-minded and receptive climate and culture where you invite feedback from persons who are probably more likely to detect that implicit bias is occurring than others. And this is where the concept of privilege comes into play, where we're accustomed to doing things from our privileged positions that it's not our fault, but if we're not allowing those persons who might see something differently because they have to, because they're in a disprivileged position, then we may miss out on something. And so those are just some things, as I mentioned earlier, I have so much more, and I've so enjoyed this opportunity to share just a little bit for everyone to recognize that this is a richly complex topic that has phenomenal positive implications for how we all can really accomplish what we're striving, which is health equity, which is to ensure that we have a healthy population. And to do that, we've got to be thinking about the variety of ways that we are engaging in whatever area of the profession we find ourselves.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Allen. As we become better at what we do, then we help more people. So it's a win-win all around. Dr. Brenda Allen, thank you so much for sharing. As you said, just a small part of what you know. You are the true expert in this field, and we feel so privileged to have had you share on the podcast today. I hope you'll come back again.
You very much. I would welcome an opportunity to come back again. I have so much to share, and I'm so grateful that my career path has led me here, and I'm really, really appreciative of this time with you, which aligns with what I'm finding so many people seem to be seeking answers and what can we do. And that, I hope, has come through in this
interview is that with implicit bias, we really, really can make a difference. There's some challenges and problems are harder than others. This one, there is hope, and I welcome the opportunity to come back and share more.
Well, thank
and
you.
I thank you for what you're doing to illuminate these issues and to help all of us make our world a better place.
Well, thank you. I'm just really looking forward to speaking with you again. And for now, everyone, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. And until next time, I hope that everybody stays happy and healthy. Until then, everybody, take good care, and we'll see you soon.
You've been listening to the Doctor's Life Podcast with Diane Ansari-Wynn, MD. Go to www.dianeansari-wynn.com to read show notes, listen to past episodes, share your comments and show ideas, and pick up your free PDF and video of easy and proven strategies that will melt your daily stress away. That's www.dianeansari-wynn.com.